Tooth and Nail brought this truth to the forefront. Christian music can be badass. I'm 46 years old. I'm not trying to sound cool, but I remember friends hearing Wish for Eid sometime Sunday, and they're legit like, this is not a step down.
I was in a bad spot and was just eating up some Black Mirror. I was watching it every night, loving it. The world sucks, people suck, life sucks. And I remember sitting before God and being like, oh, I'm in such pain. And he's like, well, then what are you doing?
As Christians, we felt punk rock about our beliefs. Not only do we now have music that we don't have to explain, but it's also representing our faith.
An artistic depiction of a thing is not necessarily an endorsement. It could be anti. All depends on the context.
You know, especially in light of the gospel, that we've been saved from the law and now we can actually live with the Spirit. We could say, Lord, I want to explore all sorts of arts. I know that I am not bound by the law, but I want your Holy Spirit still. I think that's the path that's mapped out for us.
Yeah, Jeff Ballou's ministry-esque industrial metal thing.
Wait, it was like a more intentional ministry-wise?
Well, no, oh, I mean,
no, you meant the band?
The band ministry.
You tricked me. That is so funny. I was thinking, oh, that's, I didn't know that he meant that as a ministry band.
The breaking point was the 90 Pound Wuss album, Rare Meager Die of Self-Interest. That was something that really spoke to me and my goth sensibilities. I would bring that record to church and I got like a sit down and don't bring this around anymore. The youth pastor was like, I sat down with it. I read the lyrics. You need to knock it off. And I remember being like, dude, we can't do it.
I like demanded, pleaded, called God on promises and was like, you have to show up or like I am done. And he did. And he did.
That's something to really think about. What does it mean that the God of the universe loves me?
Are we saying that our God is bigger than their God or what?
Man, you got my mind going crazy right now.
I just think that that is evangelical bullshit.
And I don't fit in their box anymore. So feeling rejected from the church makes me feel far away from God.
If I'm living out the love of God, love of the divine, then in some ways we're unoffendable.
It's wrong to marginalize anybody for any reason.
Sometimes we can just have some things about our perspective that's off until we encounter someone who can challenge our thoughts, have conversations with us, and we just continue to grow and evolve.
I'm with you there. I like that.
That sounded like womp, 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 womp to Rob.
I'm a hardcore gospel lover. I do love the gospel. I just think we get it wrong.
Girl, I was so highly medicated, I don't even know if you... Oh, God, my people.
All right, it is the pastor with no answers with my best friend in the world. We go back, decades? We've spent tons of time together. Just kidding. It's probably our second conversation, but we know we like each other, right?
Yeah, Josh? Oh yeah, for sure.
We definitely like each other. Yeah. Hey, I've been looking forward to this, man. You just, in January, you released With All Its Teeth, Sex, Violence, Profanity, and the Death of Christian Art. Does it feel good to have that release, man?
It does, yeah. Writing a book is a lot of fun, to me anyway. And then everything...
Yeah, some people would say that is an opinion.
Yeah. I actually deeply enjoy the writing part, and I don't like everything after that.
Yeah, you know,
editing and design work. And all, I mean, it's all very satisfying. It's like... making anything. People who make anything will understand. Everyone has their parts of the process that they like and don't like. I like the actual creation of the thing. And then it's very satisfying to see it to fruition, for sure. And to be able to hold it and go, wow, look, there's a thing that I made. But the work that is required to make people aware of the fact that you made a thing is not always the most fun. I mean, I like things like this. I like having conversations and talking to people about it. But, you know, I'm not Mr. Social Media. I have to get on social media and tell people I wrote a book. Right. I feel like a doofus sometimes.
Right.
That's a long answer to say, yeah, it feels good to finish another thing. And then you got to do some work you don't like and some work you do like, all part of the process, I suppose.
Well, let me tell you how I prep for this conversation. Like, I've been doing this for so long, it typically is just easy anyway, but this was so easy. Oh my gosh. All I did is I went and I read a little bit about the book. And I read reviews on Amazon. But before I even read reviews on Amazon, I just read what the book was about. And I thought, what questions would I come up with just knowing what the book is about? And I wrote out a bunch of questions. And then I read the reviews and a little bit more, and I filled in some gaps. A lot of this stuff is things that I would talk about very naturally. I'm excited about it. But let me ask you something that just happened to me, given you and I have similar backgrounds. What do you think about this? And this is a very close person to me. I love them to death, so I'm not going to mention their names because I don't want it to sound like I'm making fun, but we will get a chuckle out of this. And at the same time, it's a serious question. I was talking to somebody. They sent their spouse to Sam's Wholesale, and the person that was going to Sam's was supposed to run some errands first and then go to Sam's at 10 when it opens. He made some mistakes and basically went straight to Sam's. It was 9 o'clock and they were already open. So he tells his spouse, yeah, I went to Sam's. And she's like, yeah, but they're closed. Why'd you go now? You were supposed to go later. And he's just like, well, I just didn't know, but they're open. And the other person's like, man, I cannot believe they're open. It must be a God thing, because I looked it up last night and I saw they were open at 10. If they are open at 9 and you drove all the way over there, that's a God thing. So first of all, the phrase God thing is just funny anyway. But question that I have, so I don't see it as a God thing. I see it as mistake on the internet. Hey, we just decided to open an hour early, or maybe they just changed the policy and the update hasn't been made on the website. Do you agree with that first, like that assessment? Would you be like, come on.
Okay. So far, so good.
So my second question is, do you think that there's any harm for them to just correlate God into that? What the hell? That was a real good thing. Must be a God thing. Like, is there any harm in that from you and I, who would say probably not a God thing, it's probably just normal. They want to attribute it to God. Any harm in that?
Well, yes and no. I think that there's kind of two dimensions of it. One is the question of like providence, and the other is a question of gratitude. Providentially, I agree with you. I don't think personally, and I would not presume to know exactly what God, it's possible, I guess, that God, sure, by intervention of his spirit in people, moved things around to accommodate this random mistake.
Right.
It's possible. I doubt that that's what happened. It doesn't seem like under normal circumstances, that's how God operates in the world. And there's all kinds of contingencies that would, like you said, it's probably just bad listing or an old hours that were posted somewhere, or someone made a mistake down the line.
I love my parents though, man. You probably could already pick that one out. I was like,
I wasn't going to say anything, but so yeah, it doesn't seem like that would be the case based on everything we know about the nature of Sam's Wholesale and listings and just the way God ordinarily intervenes and doesn't intervene, at least according to my theological perspective. So where there's a yes and there could be harm in that is when that, at least according to my theological perspective, when that view is taken all the way to its logical conclusion, and then like, okay, well, is it not a God thing when something really bad happens to you, like that, that why attribute this one random turn to, like good turn of fortune to God, as opposed to any other random thing that happens in life that you could just attribute to random circumstances, chaos, people's autonomy, all kinds of stuff like that.
Right. And you can even stay with this situation and say, what if he showed up at 9:15, saw the sign was 10? Why wouldn't he think, wow, this must be a God thing. I need to learn some patience.
Yeah.
I'm going to sit in the car for 45
totally,
minutes.
Totally. Totally.
It must be a God thing.
So, yeah, I think that along those lines, and I would never wag my finger at somebody and be like, don't you dare attribute this nice little twist of your morning to God. But I would encourage people to like, okay, well, maybe, but let's think about all these other things that could possibly factor in why there was a mix up on the time schedule of Sam's wholesale. Yeah. And because if we take that kind of logic all the way to its inevitable conclusion, I think you end up with lots and lots of problems that ultimately, not to be too fire and brimstone, kind of destroy or erode faith at least. So that's it could be dangerous or harmful. On the other hand, there's a moment I think about a lot in my own life when I was on tour playing music, and some friends and I had gone to New Zealand to play a festival, and went some Kiwi folks had tricked us into taking a hike that they said would take 2 hours. It took 10. and we were lost in the dark. It was a very unpleasant day. It started off awesome. You know, you're in the wilderness of New Zealand. This is amazing. And then you realize that they were lying to us. We're going to be out here all day.
We may not make it. You went from beautiful day to don't know if we're going to make it out of this day.
And they're like, oh, it's hilarious. You know, they're lost, you know. And we didn't think it was funny at the time. But there was someone amongst us who I consider to have kind of a mature spiritual formation, especially in terms of his like intimacy with God, his closeness to God, and his sense of gratitude for the things of God. And there was a moment at the end of the day where we were like, everyone was wet and the sun had gone down. Now we're all cold and everyone's miserable and complaining. His cantankerous mood had infected the entire atmosphere. And we're like, man, we're so cold. And he's like, we should pray and ask God to warm us up. And that's not what you want to hear when you're grumpy, someone being right, more mature than you are. So he's like, hey God, we're real cold, you know. And he wasn't being facetious, and he wasn't even being kind of pious. He just had a good natured, like, I don't know, why not? Let's just pray. And we kept on walking. And then a few moments later, a really warm breeze came in and warmed everyone up. And we were near the coast. So there are all these natural phenomena that you could attribute to this, you know, like, well, really this warm front came in because of this. And this dude started celebrating and worship. And he was like, oh man, that's so cool. We asked God to warm us up. And then we got warm. I think in that moment, I was no longer grumpy, but I was genuinely curious about the theological implications, not to be that guy. And I was just like, well, I don't know. You know, is it that we ask God to warm us up and he sent a warm front in? Or is it that we just, you know, we happened to be walking, it was warm? And I realized, like, the dude, he got all that. It wasn't like I was blowing his mind. He was like, oh, I know. I mean, I know it. He's like, but we did ask for something and then it happened. So like, I'm grateful that we got the thing we asked for, even if it's not necessarily that the hand of God came down. And so I think he had like a really balanced perspective that steered him naturally toward gratitude. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I'm sorely lacking in my, you know, I kind of lean toward cynicism and pessimism by my personality, which is not a good thing. It's a bad thing. And I remember thinking like, good Lord, what a wonderful way to navigate like with the maturity to be like, well, I know that it's not necessarily a God thing in the specific like unilateral theological sense, but it is a God thing in that I wanted something. I asked for it. I got the thing I wanted. I can be grateful for that. And I choose to attribute that gratitude to God, even if, you know, it wasn't his direct intervention in the world. We all know that.
For sure.
I mean, there are people who exemplify gratitude and they're typically nicer, more generous and kind.
Yeah.
So I think in that sense, there's probably something really healthy about being like, hey, man's morning turned out pretty good. Must be
right,
a God thing. In that sense, being just like choosing to, you know, the definition of prayer I give to my people in church is like life with God. You're just being like a God thing, meaning cool, a good thing happened to me. If that's what you mean by it, then I think that's probably pretty
sure,
healthy and pretty wise and mature. If what you mean by that is like God kind of interfered in the fabric of space time specifically to change the hours of set. And I'm not saying I don't believe that God interferes in space. Of course, I believe, you know, as a Christian, that God is involved and active and he does things and he intervenes. you know, prayer, all that stuff. But, you know, I tend to think he probably doesn't change the hours of Sam's,
right,
you know, based on a fluke, but I could be wrong. But I don't really think that if you're like, well, you know, I don't know that God specifically did that just for me, but I'm grateful. And I, you know, and I choose to see this as something that even in the small things, you know, of God's like presence in my life, that's probably a wonderful thing. So
yeah,
more power to the parents.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I think you and I went in different directions with our faith. Like I would say that I deconstructed tons and I'm still a Christian. So what I've noticed with myself personally, that I am much more able to now hear a theological perspective that I don't really jive with and yet can find some truth in it. What you just described. Like I'm thinking, I mean, God created this day, you know, they lucked out. They ended up getting there early. Praise God, you know, praise God moment. How about that?
Yeah. I like that language. I think that's helpful.
All right. So this took me about 2 minutes to come up with some funny scenarios that I had when it came to secular and Christian and all of that. You're going to love these. All right. So the earliest one that I can remember, we were in youth group and I was probably 12 years old. So I was fresh in youth group and we got word that somebody had the new Bon Jovi. And I don't remember what the album was right after Slippery When Wet, but it was badass. The first song is Bad Medicine. I mean, I'd listen to that song now.
It's a great song, yeah.
What's that album called? Are you looking it up?
I'm looking it up right now because I want to know too. I had Slippery When Wet on cassette and I want to know what the follow-up was.
It's on the tip of my tongue. It's a known album, just not as known as Slippery When Wet.
But somebody at youth group had it, huh? It was New Jersey, came right after Slippery When Wet.
So we're like, oh, somebody brought that cassette. And then we all really wanted to hear it. And so we're literally walking around, sneaking, listening. And now looking back on it, it was almost just like, oh, somebody brought cocaine. Okay. Let's, you know, we're all sneaking. It's like, we're sneaking Bon Jovi. All right. So I was the kid that my parents would not sign a permission slip for educational trips to movies. So when kids went to field trips to go see Glory, Schindler's List, I was that kid who stayed home. Our youth group went to go see Dakota Motor Company. Do you remember them?
Yeah, of course.
Yep.
That was
Peter King.
Peter King was on MTV as like a VJ and a host of
Sandblast. So here's the thing. We went there and there was a, oh my gosh, what was the opening band? Oh man. It's named after someone. They definitely tried to sound like Nirvana. Oh gosh, that's going to kill me too. I'll have to find that one out later. But anyway, our youth pastor, there was a big old sign that showed Peter King and advertised his role in that MTV show. And we had about three of us that were keeping our youth pastor distracted from seeing that, because if he were to have seen that there was any involvement in MTV, we probably would have had to leave. All right. So here's another one. After Christian Skate Night, this kid was talking to us and we were talking about a Mortal album. Listeners, is an industrial band from back in the old school Christian days. And I think my brother asked him, what do you think about that album? He said, well, I listened to it all the way through, but in some of the songs I heard, you know, amongst all the songs I heard Breast and A. So it's a running joke. 30 years later, my brother and I, we can just say Breast and A, and we know exactly what he's talking about. Apparently on the Mortal album, they say Breast and Ass, and I'm thinking, well, what's wrong with breast, first of all? I remember visiting my brother in college, and he had just bought a Voodoo Glow Skulls album, a ska band, and on the cover of the CD, it said, play it loud, I thought my brother is going to burn in hell forever. I cannot believe it. And I was just, and I looked at him. I mean, it's almost like finding drugs in his dorm room. I'm like, Jared, like, are you serious? Like, how could you? Like, it destroyed me. So that is my sort of upbringing. And I love that you talk about secular and Christian. So, and I'll go ahead and tell you how I broke out of the whole secular and Christian thing, because I think they're somewhat interesting. So I dated a girl junior year of college, and she was a Christian. She was a Baptist, and she suggested to go see an R-rated movie. And I was just kind of like, I don't want to tell her that I don't watch R-rated movies. So we went and we saw the movie Breakdown, which is an awesome thriller about a guy's wife getting kidnapped. Check it out if you haven't seen Breakdown. It came out in 97 or whatever. And so from that point on, I watched R-rated movies, you know, because with her, we went and we saw, you know, sorts of movies. I think with music, it just was, it got to a point where it was irresistible. I heard Diary from Sunny Day Real Estate. Mm-hmm. And I knew that there may be some Christian elements to him because he's on Poor Old Lou album and, you know, all that sort of thing. But I remember, like, I cannot stop listening to this. I don't care if it's Christian or not. Then my brother bought me Static Prevails by Jimmy Eat World for my birthday that summer. And I was like, I just can't even. I didn't know music was out there that was this good. And then there was a record label that came out called Deep Elm Records. And it was, you know, classic emo scene. And they sent out a sampler. And I heard Marigold by Appleseed Cass. And I was like, this is probably the best song I've ever heard in my life. And then it was just like, I cannot not listen to this music. So broke out of all that secular stuff. But how legalistic were you? Does any of that stuff ring a bell to you?
Oh, yeah, big time. Well, I grew up kind of in this strange contradiction. So, you know, Southern Baptists, and we've talked about it before, but like rural Georgia, a deeply fundamentalist atmosphere, Christian national, all that stuff, like proto-Christian national, you know, like pre 9/11. The church culture was definitely as really hardcore, the same kind of environment that you're describing. And, you know, our youth group, when I was eventually in youth group, was, you know, very fretful, even of quote unquote Christian music. You know, it was kind of like, you got to be careful because they're trying to sneak something in, you know, like they're trying to trick you essentially. But, and my parents were participatory in that and they bought into some of it. Like I had the same kind of like, we couldn't watch R-rated movies. And like, even when I was a little kid, like I couldn't watch the Dungeons and Dragons Saturday morning cartoon. And it wasn't because they'd seen it and found something in it that was objectionable. It was because the cultural narrative was like, that's satanic, so it's got to go. You know what I mean?
And dude, I still have, there's a part of me when I hear Dungeons and Dragons, I'm like, that can't be good, because I came back from Myrtle Beach as a kid where my grandparents bought me and my brother Dungeons and Dragons figures, whatever. We came home and in our family devotion that night, we read scripture, we talked about good and evil, and we pulled those bastards apart and threw them away.
Oh my God. Wow. Wow. Yeah. That's intense. That's intense. Man. Yeah. And man. I came of age in the whole like, get rid of your, throw out your secular CDs or break your secular CDs and stuff, like, you know. But then at the same time, my dad was like this 70s rocker dude. You know, when I was like 10 years old, and we were at Walmart one night, he bought me a copy of the Aerosmith record, Get a Grip, on cassette tape. And I remember he handed it over the, you know, from the driver's seat of the truck to the passenger seat and said, don't tell your mom. And then my mom was more of a, you know, I hesitate to use these terms, but like a high art person. So she's really into literature and highly educated lady. And she would, when I was 10 years old, she gave me a copy of The Metamorphosis by Kafka. So I had these experiences coming from my parents, who were also the people who were like, you can't watch Dungeons and Dragons. You can't, like, you know, they were wary of Nirvana and things like that. But then would also, my dad would be like playing, you know, A Night at the Opera by Queen in the house. And my mom would be like, oh, Jerry, do you have to, you know, it was just kind of like that, like they waffled, you know. So I already had this in on some of the culture, and, you know, some of it was like, oh, my parents would never let me. It was almost arbitrary. It was like the culture came down really hard on certain things, and that was it. You're not watching The Simpsons, even though The Simpsons were so inoffensive compared to some other thing that maybe would have gotten through. So it was really inconsistent. By the time, you know, I realize this now because I have a 10-year-old, you know, my oldest kid is 10, and I'm like, dude, you don't know anything about music. You don't know nothing. Like when I was 10, I already had favorite bands and, like, you know, albums, and they don't have you know, there's radio doesn't matter anymore. There's no MTV. There's no longer any outlets, and music doesn't have the same cultural currency it did at the time. It's kind of relegated to just top 40, almost like TikTok pop music is what they would know about from culture. But at that point, you know, like you'd be in middle school and someone, like you're describing the Bon Jovi moment, it was like someone had a copy of Dookie by Green Day, or someone had Smash by Offspring, it sounded like the most profane thing I'd ever heard in my life, but also was just like, holy crap, this is amazing. But then I had this strange, specific moment where we went to a youth camp up in North Carolina. And so it's a Southern Baptist youth camp, and they had breakout classes, sessions during the day that you could sign up for. And one of them was about music, Christian music. And I was like, cool, I'll take the music class. And there was a dude who was in the know, so to speak. You know, this was my first exposure to Tooth and Nail Records. I didn't even know that was a thing. I must have been.
You know,
like,
what year this was around?
I was 11. It must have been like 93, 94, or something like that.
Yeah, so right around Tooth and Nail's beginnings. Wish for Eden, Blank Eye, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, so it was first generation Tooth and Nail. And I remember he specifically would do this bit in the class where he would play records and ask people to, you know, say like, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about these lyrics? And he was, I think at the time, trying to do a little bit of what I'm doing in this new book, expand people's like palette for different kinds of art. And he specifically played a record by a first generation Tooth and Nail band called Chatterbox, which was
Jeff Bailu.
Yeah, Jeff Bailu's ministry-esque industrial metal thing. And at that time,
I didn't know it was like a more intentional ministry-wise.
Well, no,
you meant the band.
The band ministry.
You tricked me. I forgot about ministry.
No, yeah.
That is so funny. I was thinking, I didn't know that he meant that as a ministry band.
It was clearly influenced by the industrial metal band Ministry,
right.
Which is decidedly not Christian.
Right.
And I had discovered at this point, so post around 94 was when the Downward Spiral by Nine Inch Nails came out. And that was the record that like changed, you know, this sounds so hackneyed, but kind of changed my life. You know, it was like the first time I heard it. You know, I put it in and sat there in front of the stereo, listened to it from start to finish with the book in my hand, and was like, oh, man, I don't think my perspective on music will ever be the same. And it was, you know, everyone that loves music has at least one record like that, usually more than one, but that you're just like, you kind of can't dig deep enough into it. And because I like Nine Inch Nails, that had made me go look for bands like Ministry or you know, like this would be the time where the most accessible mainstream acts were like White Zombie or, you know, the industrial metal stuff had kind of permeated the mainstream a little bit. So to me, this thing that I was hearing in the Christian class, like it sounded authentically like an industrial metal band, not a parody, not a Christian parody of one. And I was like, oh, holy crap. I had no idea. And then I went and talked to the guy afterward. I was like, where did you find this? And is there something else like that? And he asked me about more records I like. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I like the Offspring record. I was telling him, you know, I like industrial music. I'm into this, but this was also when skate punk had become a mainstay of like MTV. So bands like Green Day and Offspring would be on the weekly top 40 all the time. And he's like, oh, if you like that stuff, you should try this. And he gave me a copy of the first MXPX record, Pokin' Atcha. Mm-hmm. It sounded more punk than the Green Day record by far. It was like way more rough around the edges. It was faster, really abrasive. Like vocally, it was really abrasive. I was like kind of flabbergasted. I was like, this, it felt to me edgier and more underground, I guess, you know, than Green Day. Everyone I knew liked Green Day. That was, and I've always been, you know, to a fault, the person that's like, if it gets popular, I just don't like it anymore.
Sure.
So this felt like something that was uniquely mine, and it felt cool. I mean, I know that sounds really lame to be at youth camp and getting a Christian CD, but then you open the liner notes and they're wearing like Rancid and NoFX shirts on the inside. And I was like, who's that? So now I'm going and buying these records. I remember I went and got the first compilation that Tooth and I don't know if it wasn't the first compilation, but the first Penalty Box compilation. They had these series called Songs from the Penalty Box. Mm-hmm.
Did you just tell me that or our listeners? Because if you told me that, I'm offended.
Yeah, I know that you're completely aware of the Penalty Box record. But to the listeners who may not know, Tooth and Nail used to release a series of compilations called Songs from the Penalty Box Volume 1. It was almost like their Punk-O-Rama. Epitaph had Punk-O-Rama compilations, and Tooth and Nail would do just Songs from the Penalty Box. I hadn't even got a chance to play it yet, but I brought it to church. And it became like the Bon Jovi record where people are like, oh, listen to where'd you get this? This is Christian. And since I hadn't got a chance to play it all the way through, I was hanging out, socializing, and came back into the place where some people were gathering around a stereo. And the Living Sacrifice track was playing. It must have been Reject or something from Reborn. I remember thinking, like, what the heck is that? And someone, ingrained in my memory, pointed at the stereo, like, and turned around and looked at me and said, "This is a Christian band." And I was like, yeah, I mean, I guess I got it from the Christian bookstore. And if you've heard earlier, post death metal Living Sacrifice, when they were like a thrash.
Reborn album, I definitely recall for sure.
Yeah, yeah. You know? It's a very heavy record. And our heavy, you know, like, we had edgy kids in youth groups, like someone liked Pantera and someone liked White Zombie. And they were like, dude, this is heavier than Pantera. This is heavier than White Zombie. All that to say, like, I had this kind of strange overlapping experience where there was some of that, like, oh, it's all bad. You know, you can't be a Christian and like this kind of art, especially, you know, my parents were so troubled by my affinity for Nine Inch Nails. And, you know, they took the record away. They broke the, you know, that was my Dungeons and Dragons. They broke it in front of me. Like, you cannot let this sin into your life. But then at the same time, I was having this almost overlapping experience where I'm like, there seems to be a credible world of authentic, not a put on, not a parody. Cause, you know, like, I'd been raised on Christian alternative music. I don't mean to assess the authenticity of these bands, but there were often bands that record labels like Forefront, you know, and they were part of the CCM machine that felt like, you described the opening act of that you went and saw, like they were trying to be Nirvana. All right, here's a band that clearly wants to offer you a Christian version of Bush, you know, or something like that. When I discovered Tooth and Nail, it felt to me like these guys don't sound like they're trying to be anyone else. In fact, they sound more on the cusp of like relevance than these mainstream acts, you know, like it's edgier than Offspring. It's heavier than Pantera. Clearly they're being, I guess, influenced by stuff I don't even know about. I've never heard of NoFX and Rancid, you know, that kind of thing.
That's what made Tooth and Nail so special, is there was definitely an underground music scene that was legit, really cool bands, like, you know, mellow bands like The Choir all the way to, you know, Poor Lou and that sort of thing. But it's like Tooth and Nail brought this truth to the forefront, and that was Christian music can be badass. And I know, I'm not trying, you know, I'm 46 years old. I'm not trying to sound cool, but I remember friends hearing Wish for Eden in the car, Sometimes Sunday in the car, and they're legit like, this is not a step down.
Yeah.
Like giving it creds. And it was a lot. That's the thing, is Tooth and Nail, you know, you have Brandon over in Seattle seeing all these acts, and he's like, holy shit, I just got to sign all these guys, you know? I mean, it really legitimized the music scene, you know, for Christians.
The diversity of genre represented by even first and second generation Tooth and Nail, to me, was this semi-utopian moment in underground music where my friends and I would buy these compilations. Compilations were a wonderful thing back then for indie labels that you could, for really cheap. They were ordinarily like $5. They'd have 20 songs on them, and end up buying like 7 of the albums because I bought a Solid State compilation, heard Zayo for the first time. So I bought 2 Zayo records. But you had a record label who would release Zayo and Joy Electric, who had industrial metal bands like Chatterbox, or Clank was an early thing that they had, but then would have these kind of first wave emo acts that sounded like Sunny Day Real Estate. They didn't sound different, or if they did, it sounded respectably different, not like they're trying, but they don't know how to do it. And then you had bands as heavy as Living Sacrifice, and then you had pop punk bands. That kind of diversity wasn't really represented by similar indie labels at the time, like an Epitaph, who did have a diversity of punk rock music for sure, or, you know, Hopeless Records. These are other record labels that we'd go buy compilations, and we were punk rock kids and really into that kind of thing. But to us, Tooth and Nail sincerely lived alongside that pantheon of underground music, and not like, yeah, trust me, it's cool, it's Christian, but if you give it a chance, you know, like it effortlessly played alongside those things. So my upbringing, I completely had that experience of like the apprehension of culture, the fear of culture, especially when it came to art and entertainment. It's all bad. Don't watch rated R movies. Don't, you know, watch The Simpsons. Don't listen to this kind of music. But then by the, it was a God thing. It was a God thing.
There you go.
This other world kind of infiltrated my experience. And so
God was just showing off, brother.
He was showing off. To me, it seemed as if what Trent Reznor was doing on the downward spiral was, you know, singing about his experience and his worldview through like in a really, really unique and creative way. And so was MXPX. So was Chatter. But, you know, like these, they're people who are singing about their worldview through these genres of music that I happen to enjoy. So it was easy for me to naturally do away with the sacred secular thing in the arts. And even though there was overwhelming pressure from my church to reinforce the sacred secular, you know, the breaking point was the 90 Pound Wuss album, Where Meager Die of Self-Interest. You know, that was something that really spoke to me and my goth sensibilities, and was hardcore punk and everything. And I would, this is when I was like in high school now, and I would bring that record to church and I got like a sit down and someone was like, dude, don't bring this around anymore. Like the youth pastor was like, I sat down with it. I read the lyrics. It's not cool. You need to knock it off. And I remember being like, dude, what?
Yeah.
We can't even like talk about sincerely like Christian. And in this case, like kind of blatantly, explicitly Christian music. And by that, I mean, like, it wasn't highly metaphorical songs about Jesus, you know, that kind of thing.
And that story right there is what fueled the fire, because as Christians, whether you liked it or not, we felt punk rock about our beliefs, because not only do we now have music that we, like you said, that we don't have to explain, but it's also representing like our faith. Well, I'll tell you this. I remember I would see things like this happen where I guess I'd call it like a unhealthy form of punk rock Christianity. We would see, I saw a kid get saved in youth group. And he was, you know, living a reckless lifestyle and listening to all the secular music. And it was almost overnight. Next thing you know, he's complaining about MXPX follow-up albums, not talking about Jesus enough. He became punk rock about his faith. And so that actually, I think, fueled this fire of, we do believe in and Jesus and the cross. What's up? You hear this music we're listening to too? You know, it's just kind of like a punk rock feel to it all.
Yeah, totally. You know, there was, and punk rock lends itself to like kind of a gatekeeping mentality. Is it punk enough? Is it authentically punk? Prove that it's punk. Is it, you know, and then we create these arbitrary metrics of like, well, they don't look punk. You know, the Breakthrough Refused record that changed everyone's lives in 98 or whatever it was, The Shape of Punk to Come, when it came out, there was a sense of like, what the heck? These guys look like the Beatles. Is this punk? Like, why are they dressing all mod? Mod isn't punk, you know? That kind of mentality, you know, lends itself to certain ideologies. Even straight edge was, you know, like I never said this when I was traveling playing music, but I've been straight edge my whole life. But it back then, it wasn't like people be like, oh, so are you straight edge? I'd be like, well, technically, but I don't like to say that term, because it came with all this baggage of like this militance and self-righteousness, even more so than like the Christian punk scene. Honestly, there was like almost a gang mentality about straight edge, and the Christian gatekeeping philosophy, especially over indie music, punk rock music. On the one hand, I understand, because people develop this deep affection for the artist that they love, and they feel as if their lives have been shaped for the better by something that these artists have made. And then if our artist deviates from whatever it was that they said, you know, or seems to deviate, there's a sense of like, well, hold on now. You were the person that meant something to me. And are you saying we're not, you know, because we often lack the maturity to be able to say like, that's it, you know, even if they don't believe what I believe anymore, that doesn't mean I don't have to believe it anymore. And it doesn't mean that the thing they made is any less meaningful to me now. This is something that I've desperately tried to communicate in the book across decades of conversations with people about art, is that of course there can be and will be something that so deeply offends your personal sensibilities that you just don't enjoy it. And that's fine. That's understandable. You shouldn't be made to feel like an idiot if you just don't like something, you know, ideologically, and it affects your experience of it aesthetically.
Yep.
That said, it's probably healthy to have a baseline maturity that allows you to take in certain kinds of art and entertainment that are contrary to your worldview in significant ways, that you can still appreciate aesthetically, that you can still appreciate in terms of craftsmanship, and even communicatively, even if it's communicating something contrary to your worldview, and be able to say like, well, I don't agree with what the artist is communicating with this particular piece, but I appreciate this. I like this about it. And that, I think, makes us better artists. And it makes us, as Christians, for those of us that are Christians, it enriches our spiritual discipline of art appreciation, which helps us understand the Bible better. It helps us understand how we commune with God better, to have a more robust kind of palette for all kinds of different art. And the irony, you know, in my own experience as an artist, is that for a very long time, I made the kind of stuff, I don't mean to hype it up or anything, but because it was always a small spectacle, but I made the kind of music and art that offended a certain kind of conservative Christian sensibility, because it was too strange or too dark or too upsetting. And, you know, the band I was in, Showbread, always had this battle with like the Christian industry, you know, like, oh, they're not going to put it in Christian bookstores if you don't change this, or if you don't provide some kind of explanation. So that was always an ongoing conflict. And then, you know, years and years go by, and just a couple of years ago or a year ago, Showbread made a new record that kind of was designed to accompany this book I'd written about deconstruction. And suddenly that backlash was just on the other side of the aisle. There was this outrage about like, how dare you call into question, you know, what the way I see things? How dare you say this thing? I can't bear it. I won't hear it. I won't listen to it. And I found it like kind of incredible. I was like, well, you don't have to agree with it. And I would see, you know, people would write me, or I'd see things online where they say like, well, musically, I really love it, but I'm not going to listen to it. I won't listen to it for a second because I don't agree with this and this. I'm like, I you know, ever since I'm not trying to like pit myself against people, but I think like when I was in high school, I was a Christian and I bought a copy of Antichrist Superstar, because I thought it sounded awesome, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, like, because The Beautiful People was on the radio, and I was like, it was undeniably a catchy song.
Oh, and I would have felt so convicted at that. Like, I think that's neat that you had that journey. Like, I don't have any reference point of like enjoying just all kinds of music in high school, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that it was almost by accident, but I was able to play a record like Antichrist Superstar, recognize the things that he's critiquing. And I was even able to say, oh, he's kind of right about this, and he's kind of right about that. I fundamentally disagree on this thing, but aesthetically, it really speaks to me. And I even like the imagery and the way that it's used in this, you know, even still now, it's such a pervading, standoffish, like, well, you said something I don't like, therefore I refuse to receive any of it. And I think that often puts, not always, but often puts us at a kind of spiritual deficit. If you're not able to even wander a wing of an art museum and, you know, be able to recognize certain aesthetic qualities in works of art and find in them something to appreciate. And, you know, I think that this is something that really matters to God. Art really matters to God. And that's not like my quirky idea I made up. That's evident from Genesis to Revelation, just in the story of the scriptures. God prefers art as his means of communicating with people. And it's often really dark, really upsetting, or abstract, or confusing.
Give us an example of a preferred means of God communicating when it's upsetting.
Well, you know, like the majority of God's speech in the Bible is depicted as poetry, like quantifiably. If you count God talking to people throughout the Old and New Testament, the majority of it's poetry. And the biggest volume of poetry that we have in the Hebrew scriptures is the Psalms. And most of the Psalms are not pretty I mean, they're beautiful poems, but they're not overtly uplifting and celebratory, at least not start to finish. There are psalms that are about despair, suicidal ideation. There are psalms that are about a deep sense of God's absence, and that don't then resolve themselves. You know, some psalms are beautiful, and they're like, you know, Psalm 69 comes to mind, where it's like this, like the waters are over my head, I'm in complete despair. And the psalmist even says like, my eyes wear out looking for God. Like, that's how hard I'm looking and not seeing God. And then there's a resolve. He says, but I will trust in you. There's a kind of a decisive, like, even though everything's awful, I decide to trust in God. And I think that's how we assume all the dark Psalms go, but they really don't. A lot of them do not resolve. A lot of them end on that note of agony, and that's just it. You know, it's just like, there's no one, there's nothing. We have an entire book of wisdom literature where the refrain is nothing matters. Everything's meaningless. Everything's meaningless.
And it's so edifying depending on where you are in your head when you turn to God's word. Like, that can actually be very edifying to be gosh, I need to remember that. You know, if you understand nuance and you understand, you know, there's sides to everything, you don't think, oh, okay, so life sucks, I'll just be a nihilist. No, you're like, you know, life is really beautiful, and my gosh, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It's all going away. You know, there's truth to both of those things.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you're talking about understanding it in the context of the greater library of scripture. You know, we don't read Ecclesiastes 1:1 and go, oh, dang, I had no idea. Nothing matters. Therefore, I'm a nihilist, like you said. Well, we just understand that it has its place. And then I love the way you put it, that it can be uniquely edifying, even in a dark place, to have a sense of solidarity with the author and with God, to know that, like, oh, okay, so this is not alien to the human experience. This is part of the human condition, to struggle with this, a sense of meaninglessness or purposelessness in life. And according to my theology, you know, of course, there's human authors in the scripture, but God is the divine co-author. And so God is going, yep, this poem, put it in there. Yep, this, you know, these refrains, everything's meaningless, that goes in there. Like, even think of some of our more beautiful redemptive analogies or visuals in the Bible. Like, I think of Ezekiel's Valley of Dry Bones, where God gives Ezekiel this vision of salvation. Like, this is how I'm going to rescue my people. And it's horrifying. It's like he's surrounded by corpses, and it explicitly says that they're like kind of snaked back together with ligaments and muscles, and they shudder back to life. And, you know, we read it and we're like, cool, yeah, I've heard the story, Valley of Dry Bones. God's going to save his, he's going to bring dead things back to life. Let's write a worship song. The visual is actually terrifying. If I were to make it a movie somehow and put it on a screen at church, people would be deeply upset. But that's how God chooses to communicate the hope of salvation. Think of even the way that Jesus, when he first his first mentions of what would become the sacred practice of communion and the Lord's Supper, is if you don't eat my flesh and if you don't drink my blood, then you don't have life in you. And we're explicitly told that the audience is like, what the, you know, they're like this, the actual quote is, this is a hard teaching. Who can accept it? You know? And then Jesus turns to his friends. He's like, are you offended? Are you offended too? But doesn't say, hey, don't worry, it's a metaphor. It's going to make sense later, you know? And yet, the culture of Christian arts, at least in Western Protestantism, has this kind of aversion to anything that could possibly alienate anyone. The idea is to make everything as palatable and comprehensible as humanly possible, lest anyone possibly misunderstand anything, even slightly. And I don't see that kind of concern in the artistry of Jesus. You know, he specifically...
Dang, that's a good point, dude.
He gives these parables, which is a creative, you know, like it, that's art, the teaching as parable. He chooses to prefer parables. And some of the parables are like, you know, beautiful. The prodigal son, you can read it anytime. It makes perfect sense. It's not like a thickly veiled metaphor or anything like that. But then there are other metaphors that still are just like, what was that? And then it ends with, and then servant was cut to pieces, you know, and you're like, what the heck? These are offensive images, dark, gruesome images. And that's how Jesus is like, this is how I'm going to communicate the truth of salvation, of judgment, and of, you know, of things to come. You know, that's the art of God. That's the artistry of God. And if you read like the scriptures with an eye for when does God preferring wild visual symbolism or poetry or parable, like if you were to cut each one of those instances out, you'd end up with a pamphlet. It's just so, you know, I sat down to write this book. I was going to begin with Genesis and do a biblical theology of art, and not just art, but kind of like wild, outrageous art in the Bible. And I thought it was going to be like, oh, this is going to be really hard. I might have to do like some weird stuff to make it make sense. And it was such a slam dunk. I'm not even in a braggy kind of way. I was just like, oh my gosh, it's such an easy argument to make from the very beginning to the very end. It's just overflowing with all kinds of wild art, abstract art, offensive art, profane art, beautiful art, uplifting art, clear art, concise art, abstract art, confusing art. And if that's the way that God chooses to communicate to his people, to human beings, like, we should have a palette for that. We should have a shelf for different kinds of art. And I'm convinced personally that, you know, like a kind of ongoing issue of generational biblical illiteracy that arrives at certain passages in the scriptures. And I'm not trying to say that this solves every problem one might have with the Bible at all. But I think a lot of them, I end up having conversations, but, you know, as a pastor, I sit with people and they're like, and I'm like, well, okay, but let's choose to look at it not as a science textbook and as a work of art. And work of art doesn't mean not true. I think that when you start to understand God as an artist, it helps us understand the Bible. The Bible actually becomes the kind of art that I've always loved. It's like beautiful and redemptive, but it's also dark and upsetting, and it's abstract and confusing and ambiguous and also clear. Like, that's everything I love in a work of art. And that helps me understand the Bible. Again, not as not true. Like, I don't mean art means therefore it's a fable and all that kind of stuff. I think it's, you know, as a Christian, like the truth of God, but also like the greatest feat of literary sophistication in history. So it's not a hard case, you know what I mean, to make. It's not a difficult argument to make that God cares about art.
Yeah, I just had an interesting conversation yesterday, actually. So I don't know if you know this, but I've been part of the same church now for about 22 years, and this is a mega church. Hey, these are good people. They're just trying to do the best they can, you know. Yep. So it's family to me. And they have me producing their podcast. And our lead pastor, you know, he told me behind the scenes, he's just like, yeah, I've had people that work here that wanted to start a podcast. And in my mind, it was like, we're going to wait until Joey starts this thing. And it was for the purpose of, I don't want this to be very churchy. Mm-hmm. Joey's our guy because it won't come across super Christian-y, but it will still have spiritual elements. Well, that's how the podcast is. It is, there's conversations about all kinds of stuff. There's encouraging stories. There's some debates, but then we brought on Michael Gunger to talk about his lack of faith. And we talked to Bart Ehrman, who's a former Christian, now atheist. That's not even close to the majority of the content, but there were, so we have a sizable leadership team of, I don't know, 12 people, you know, that run our church. They meet about 12 people. It's not just one person calling the shot sort of thing. And there are people on that team who really want the podcast to be churchy. And they're just like, hey, we need to reel this in a little bit. Like when people listen to this thing, we want them to, you know, experience God and experience church. And it's almost like, okay, wait a second. We are a church that we provide what you're talking about on Sunday mornings. And now we have a podcast where our pastor wanted this to be a vehicle for having conversations outside of Sunday mornings. And we even call the podcast Things You Won't Hear on Sunday. It's something different. There's a demographic of people that are eating it up. They love it. They're like, I can't believe you guys are having conversations like this at this mega church. And you want to reel it in and make it the same. And I love your analogy of, you know, God has magnificence, and there's different, I think you even said different shelves of ways of reflecting and sharing and creating. But you'll get a kick out of this story too. So I don't know if you knew that I played the first Emory show and go way back with those guys. And before Emory, there was a band called Joe 747, and that was basically me and Toby, and then we would rotate in and out different guitarists and drummers. Well, there's a song called Anne Marie, very poppy, nothing like, I mean, Emory was poppy, but this is like not screamy, very singy songy. And the words went, you say that you don't want me anyway. Well, that's just fine. No, you don't want me anymore. Well, that's just fine. So you're headed out the door. We had a drummer at the time that said, I'm not going to play this song when you guys are singing about a girlfriend that you're just sending out the door. Toby and I were flabbergasted. We're like, what are you talking about? This is a silly, lighthearted song. He's saying, you don't want me anymore. That's just fine. Well, you're headed towards the door. It's just a song. And he would not play drums with that lyrical content. I mean, isn't that crazy?
Hey, wow, that guy had some serious scruples.
That's
wow.
Some serious stuff, man. Serious stuff. I actually want to try to get in like five or six more questions. So weave in the contents of your book with it, but I'm going to try to jump from one thing to the next. So the first one would be, there is an element of, I think, places where you and I would say, hey, that there was a line crossed. Like, I have no desire in seeing paintings of Jesus doing pornographic sexual acts, or Jesus dressed up like a demon drinking blood. Like, I don't like that. And I would say a lot of it is even offensive to me. However, Jesus on a t-shirt slam dunking a basketball, I don't care. That's fine. honestly, there's people who wouldn't like that shirt, but they wore the whole his pain, your gain bench press this shirt with it that made Jesus look like he was Batman, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, yep, or whatever. To you, where is the line of art? And then, shit, that's just blasphemous, dude. Like, why would you even like that or listen to that? And I'll say this, I can listen to bands that are even hostile towards the faith, because I'm thinking, what happened in their life to make them this way? I mean, what if they were molested by a priest? Would you then find this offensive that they have like some bitterness towards the church? Would that change the story? So I'm even fine with people not liking the faith and being, you know, down with the Bible and all that stuff, you know, if it's good music. But the blasphemous sort of thing, like my brother is into death metal, and I think that he kind of watches what he listens to, but a lot of it is super satanic. I just don't want that. Like, for you, where is there a moral line along these lines?
Oh yeah, 100%. And this is the question that, like, I did a whole series at my church on art, and that was the question that came up the most. And I think that generationally there was a lot of concern. The younger folks in our church were kind of like, the mentality is, well, is there a line? If there is a line, objectively, how close can I get to this line without sinning? And then the older demographic in the church was like, of course there's a line, and you've been over it. Like, it's way back here. My answer is the often unsatisfying, I do believe that at least, like, you're asking about me, so, but in terms of broad audiences, I think that there are lines. I think they vary from person to person, which I think is, you know, kind of implicit in your question and the way that you're asking it. We tend to, as Christians, wonder if, like, well, surely there's got to be something that's just not good for anybody. You know what I mean? And I'm hesitant to draw that line or approve of that line, because I've seen how much it can vary from person to person. And your example is a great one, because as a Christian and as someone who, you know, like, takes what he believes very seriously, I agree 100%. Like, it doesn't really bother me to hear, like, musicians or lyrics that are aggressive toward Christianity. Most of the time, to me personally, I don't mean to sound pretentious, but they're not even that thoughtful. At least in my experience, it's more kind of aggressive. Or sometimes, like I was saying earlier, you're like, eh, well, you know, I can see this point. They're critical of, like, the church establishment or something like that. That doesn't really bother me that much. And no lyrics. I mean, I don't mean to make myself sound like as if I'm invincible, but I find it very hard to imagine any anti-Christian lyrics that would make me go, oh my gosh, my whole life is a lie. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
On the other hand, exactly what you're saying, if there was some, like, this is such a terrible example to cite, but something that was so deeply blasphemous visually, you know, to utilize the image of Jesus in some kind of hyper crass or deeply satanic, you know, like, overtly satanic way, like, I would not be into it. I would not want to see it. And not because, like, oh my gosh, it would just wound my personal sensibility so bad. It's just, I just don't want to see it. You know, like, I take this very seriously. I'm not into it. Like, and in that sense, it is offensive to me, but not in the sense that I'd, like, tear it off a wall or stage a protest or something. It's just not, I'm not into it. On the other hand, though, you know, one work of art, infamous work of art that I mentioned in the opening chapter of the book and talked about in the sermon series I did at our church is a piece by an artist called Andre Serrano called Piss Christ.
Yeah.
It's actually called Immersion Piss Christ. And the way he made it is, you know, he submerged a plastic crucifix in a jar of his own urine and took a photo of it. So it's, you know, kind of the familiar image of Jesus on the cross in this, you know, like, yellowy, golden kind of you'd have to know it was P, but the name gives it away. Allegedly, I don't know the guy personally, but he claims to be a Christian. He's Catholic.
Whoa. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Since the creation of this work, defended it as a, and I quote, Christian work of art. He claims that his, you know, the message of it, which I think is, it's not even, it's a pretty thinly veiled metaphor, is it's about the way that we desecrate the image of Jesus.
Wow.
Or about the way that our lives dishonor Jesus. You know, Sister Wendy Beckett is a Catholic nun who's also an art scholar. And her take on the piece was, she was like, she has this wonderful quote where she said, like, is it blasphemous? It could be. It could not be. It's kind of what you make of it. And she said, and I could make of it something that compelled me to worship, because she was convicted by it. She saw it and was like, that is what we do with our lives. We, you know, in practice, put Jesus in a jar of urine. And she felt convicted and compelled to, in her language, reverence the image of Christ as a result. So I had this piece in a sermon where I was going to talk about Piss Christ, and I had a slide that was going to show the piece. And one of our elders at our church is a woman who's older. She's amazing. You know, like, I would defer to her any day of the week. She's an incredible woman. And she was like, if you're going to put it on a slide, warn people, because I'd rather not see it.
Yeah.
And I was kind of surprised. I was like, Jan, it's nothing. You'll be totally fine. But then I realized, like, exactly what you're saying. There are images, there are ways an artist might use the image of Jesus that I'd be like, I don't want to see that, you know? And it's not because I don't think anyone should ever be allowed and it should be censored and burned or anything like that. It's just, I don't want to. And her line was way further back than mine. I think she's mature. I think that she's intelligent. I don't think that she's like a pearl clutcher. She, you know, like, oh my God, it'll burn our eyes or something like that. I just realized those sensibilities are different. So yeah, absolutely. I have a line, you know, and I experience it every now and then. I actually just experienced it this morning. There's a punk rock band that's been around for a very long time called The Dwarves that are about as offensive lyrically, I think, as a punk rock band could be. Because, you know, death metal bands and punk bands and these that push the lyrical envelope sometimes push it so hard it becomes almost cartoonish. I can't take a death metal band that calls itself like Smash Jesus Skulls seriously, because it sounds like, it, you know, a grade schooler came up with it or something like that. But the lyrics by this band, The Dwarves, which I think are semi-satirical, I don't know, are really gross, really blasphemous, in an almost like a playful way, which makes it even more upsetting, if that makes sense. And there's all kinds of debauchery and weird sex stuff. Musically, it's exactly the kind of thing I like very much. It's like really melodic with sophisticated melodies, but also like really edgy and hard. So it creates this real, every now and then, you know, they put out a new record, I'll be like, oh, I want to hear this for a second. And I'm grieved that I'm like, this sounds awesome. It's just grossing me out. Like, the lyrics become eventually overwhelming to me, where I'm just like, I'm just not having fun anymore listening to this, which makes me sound like my parents. And I could listen to something that maybe someone else would think is way more offensive than The Dwarves, but it just doesn't offend me the same way, if that makes sense. So yeah, I think I have a line. I think everyone should have a line, but I think it often varies from person to person. And that's part of spiritual maturity, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Very, you know, and that makes it sound like, you know, to some people they're like, oh, well then, you know, you're saying the whole truth is fluid. What's right, true for you is not true for me. And, you know, that's not what you're saying. I think that, you know, especially in light of the gospel, that we've been saved from the law and now we can actually live with the Spirit. And I even think we could say, Lord, I want to explore all sorts of arts. I know that I am not bound by the law, but I want your Holy Spirit still. I think that's how we should be living. I think that's actually the path that's mapped out for us. So of course there's going to be times, for me, I am a hip hop junkie, but I can't listen to a lot of songs that are all about women. And there's some artists, that's what they rap about all the time, is taking advantage. And I don't gravitate towards those artists because I don't like that. And, but I'm curious, like, do you see, we actually debated this on the Seacoast podcast I was telling you about earlier, horror movies, for Halloween. We had a debate on horror movies and whether or not there's a moral issue there. And I think there's very few times when there's a universal moral deal going on in entertainment, but I'm curious what you think of this example, and I'll throw violence and sex into the same equation. What if there is a movie and it is very artistically done, and let's say there's tons more to it, but part of the movie is there's a brothel where they're doing super, super kinky stuff. And there's also a part of the movie where some of the people that go to the brothel are merciless killers that kill people very violently. And there's other stuff about the movie, but the movie shows all of it, shows all the kinky sex, shows all the violence. What do you think about that? Christians, go see it or avoid it.
Well, I think, again, it depends on your sensibilities and level of maturity. And I agree 100% with what you're saying. I think that the panic that ensues if you argue that the line might be specific to the sensibilities of the individual in some cases, the panic becomes like, oh my God, are you just saying like everyone can just choose what they want to do? And that's never been my argument. The argument that I make in the book over and over again is that the way that we experience art and entertainment should be, you know, like subject to one, our discernment, meaning like, you have faculties, and you know, like it didn't take, in other words, like an intervention of the Holy Spirit for me to go, gross, I don't want to listen to this anymore. I just recognized that it wasn't good for me. But discernment's not enough, because we're faulty.
Sure.
So we need the conviction of the Holy Spirit. That's the practice of like regularly and routinely sitting before the Spirit of God and being like, you know, search me, know me, find if there's anything offensive in me. And letting God tell us, and he has told me before, like, hey, this is not healthy for you. And you're loving it. You're just eating it up. And it's not wise. And me going, oh, man, you know, like, you don't know God. I'm doing something artsy over here. You know, one example that I use in the book is that I love Black Mirror. I'm not a TV guy, but I love Black Mirror. I think it's like brilliant, prophetic. And aesthetically, I just think it's really cool. But since my bent is toward cynicism, pessimism, and kind of a honestly, if I wasn't a Christian, I'd be a nihilist. Like, that's just the way my fallen, to use the language of the scriptures, like flesh kind of gravitates toward that. And I was in a bad spot at a certain point years ago and was just eating up some Black Mirror. It was like a new season had come out. I was watching it every night and ruminating on like, man, the world does. If you've seen Black Mirror, it's really pessimistic, bleak show. And I was like, I was loving it. Like, the world sucks, people suck, life sucks. And it was reinforcing this kind of like, and it's not true. That's just not really what I believe. And I remember sitting before God and being like, oh, I'm in such pain. I was going through a lot. And he's like, well, then what are you doing with this show? Like, and he didn't say like, oh, it's wrong for all people at all times or something like that. He was just like, it's not smart. Use your head. Like, it's all you're doing is reinforcing the lie that you want to believe. And it's not true. Like, you know, so we need discernment. We need conviction from the Holy Spirit. That was conviction from the Holy Spirit. And we need the accountability of community. You need, you know, I call that church, but you need other disciples of Jesus who know your particular bents, and can call you on your crap. And we'll say, like, if I was in community with my other disciples of Jesus, brothers and sisters, and was like, they already know I'm not doing good, that I'm like struggling with despair and like self-loathing. And then like, what'd you do this week? Oh, I've been watching Black Mirror all week. They would probably say, what the heck? What are you doing that for? You know what I mean? And so I think that there are rungs of accountability through discernment, the Holy Spirit, conviction, and we should be beholden to those things. I don't think that we are ever granted a kind of unilateral permission to choose whatever we want. That's just like not the way of Jesus. You know, the way of Jesus is self-denial, and that's where we find freedom. So I believe that there is a tremendous amount of freedom to explore different kinds of art, even art that other people might find objectionable, but beholden to these other kinds of modes of accountability to other people. Mm-hmm. In that sense, I think that there are, I would say personally, definitely horror movies that depict terrible things that have a place in the spiritual formation of an individual, you know, like and you could cite easy Hollywood examples, like the Exorcist in 1973 was like a huge cultural phenomenon. And, you know, like it became like the most, it's kind of has this reputation for being the scariest movie of all time. It's just a fantastic I think it's not only the greatest horror movie of all time, I think it's one of the greatest movies. And The Exorcist was overseen by Catholic priests, everyone except for the two protagonist priests, Father Marin and Father Karras. All the other priests are actual priests in the movie that acted as consultants to be like, oh, that's not actually the way we do things. So there was a concern for the authenticity. The director, William Friedkin, was not a Christian, but he was like, I want it to be consistent with a Christian worldview in this kind of like hyperbolic, stylized Hollywood depiction of demonic oppression and demonic possession. I watch a movie like The Exorcist, which has sexually blasphemous things in it, at least the one infamous scene, and it has just terrible things that are said in it, really dark, violent, upsetting. To me, it plays as a Christian movie. It's consistent with my worldview. Granted, a stylized, fictional, version. The example I use in the book is I have a chapter called Satanic in a Good Way, and it talks about the Robert Eggers film The Witch from 2013, I believe. Which became this, again, unique cultural landmark because it was endorsed by the Satanic Temple as like an officially satanic movie.
Dang.
The Satanic Temple, though, like you imagine some kind of black building with goat sacrifices. It's really like a Twitter account. It's not exactly the world's most organized institution. Yeah. But they endorsed The Witch.
It's not like Castle Grayskull on He-Man.
No, yeah, I wish. That'd be cooler. But they endorsed this movie. And, I am a fan of this filmmaker and his or the studio that releases his films, A24. It's kind of like the Tooth and Nail Records of indie filmmaking at this point. Just a diverse pantheon of all kinds of weird movies. So I'm like, I like horror films. I'm going to go see this thing. And I was absolutely baffled at how any Satanist, these are not theistic Satanists, they're philosophic Satanists. So they're like, the devil's not real, but he represents rebellion. I'm like, how could a Satanist ever like this movie? It's 100% consistent with a Christian worldview. It depicts religious oppression as a bad thing. That's Christian. It depicts, patriarchal oppression as a bad thing. Again, that's Christian. And it depicts the devil as a real entity that does harm to human beings. That's a Christian worldview. Like the worldview of The Witch, the film, is that these are bad things that are happening, not good things. So I was baffled. I was like, what did they like about this movie? Is it just because the devil's in it? And so for some people, the reason I bring it up in the book is in a seminary class, that was the line that someone presented. Someone said, a good friend of mine, I think we can all agree, no Christian ever has any business watching a movie like The Witch. And he's not seen it, but he knew that it was endorsed by the Satanic Temple. So it's almost like the 90s equivalent of White Zombie in a movie or something, And I was like, dude, have you seen it? And he's like, no. I'm like, in the way of like graphic things, it's not even that graphic. I mean, sure, yeah, it'd be upsetting if you're not used to seeing horror movies, but there's way worse out there. Even things like depictions of sexuality in a movie. The thing that I would most like, if I could have, snap my fingers and we could all agree on something that I think is just objectively true, it would be that an artistic depiction of a thing is not necessarily an endorsement of a thing. It's not necessarily a celebration of a thing. It could be anti the thing it's depicting. It all depends on the context of the work of art and what it's depicting. For example, that piece that I mentioned earlier, Piss Christ, if we read it according to, the words of the artist himself, it is a condemnation of the desecration of the image of Jesus. But it makes its point by desecrating the image of Jesus. So right. I think a depiction of violence in a movie is not necessarily, I'm a pacifist. I write novels. My novels have extremely violent things in them because I satire violence in order to condemn violence. And I didn't make that up. That's an ordinary tool of the satirist is to depict things to show how heinous they are. I just finished reading this bestseller from an Argentinian novelist, Tender is the Flesh. And it's about a dystopian future in which human beings are being factory farmed. It's an extremely thinly veiled metaphor, about the horrors of factory farming and the depravity. It's kind of like Lord of the Flies meets Soylent Green or something like that. And I'm a vegan. So I was like, yeah, I was eating it up the whole way. I mean, it was gross. It was freaking gross. It was a really upsetting book. It had just about everything that you could assume would be upsetting in it. But I read it as if it's depicting these things in order to condemn these things. That doesn't necessarily ring true of every depiction of sexuality or every depiction of violence. So I think it just depends on the piece, and it often kind of depends on our interpretation of the piece. I don't personally even have a problem with kind of popcorn violence in something like a slasher movie, you know, the Friday the 13th or the Saw films, that kind of thing. I know that that's not what everyone wants to see, but I think even that kind of thing can provide a moviegoer with a way to approach death and survive, you know, and make light of death and be like, you know, they're essentially like, oh, geez, what would I do? You get to confront these horrible things and then leave the theater and you're okay. Mm-hmm. You know, again, I'm a pacifist. I've never seen a depiction of violence. It was like, I think I'm going to hurt somebody now that I saw this film. That's not really the risk that you run. It's like, what is it doing to your psyche? What is it doing to your soul? These are questions that I think are important to ask. So in sexuality, for example, you know, I've seen movies that depict sexuality or have nudity in them. And I can say with integrity, they didn't for a moment arouse lust in me or something like that because of the context of the movie or the way that it was depicted. Or frankly, I just don't really have a problem. I watch movies with my wife all the time and she'll tell you, like, regularly, you know, we'll watch something that has like graphic sexuality in it. And I'll just kind of turn around and look at the wall and then she'll kind of do the same thing. And then we'll glance back up. Oh, it's not over. Now mm-hmm. It's over. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that's, oh, so if you struggle, just do that. I'm just saying that to me, it's like, I don't need to put this stuff in my head per se. Other movies, the depiction of sexuality is not intended to arouse lust in anyone. You know, if you've seen like David Fincher's adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, it's got graphic sexuality in it and it's depraved and horrible and violent. And it's meant to like create an adverse reaction in you, not a scintillating reaction in you. But, you know, another filmmaker, I enjoy some of his films, is a guy named Lars von Trier, who makes a lot of upsetting movies. Some are horror, some are drama movies. He's made a film called Antichrist or Melancholia. He made a film, a two-part anthology film called Nymphomaniac. And it played at Cannes. It got a standing ovation. It's like a credible, you know, like feat of artistic filmmaking. It has real A-list actors in it. Lots of ink has been poured out over it. It also features unsimulated sex. I mean, these are actors who actually have sex in the film. And I was like, I like this guy, like his movies. All the reviews are really good. There's probably something in it that's really thoughtful and provocative that I would enjoy. I don't think I'm going to do it. And I didn't. I didn't watch it. And, you know, like, and I say the same thing. It's like, sometimes you can just exercise basic discernment. If you're in the throes of like a crippling sex addiction or porn addiction, and someone's like, let's watch the show that has graphic sexuality in it, it's just not wise for you to engage it in such a way that someone else would be like, oh, I didn't even think about that. I'm sorry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that even the stuff that you'd think would be like, geez, this isn't really, it just depends. It depends on the piece and it depends on the person.
Yeah. I haven't read the book, but I'll brag on one of the reviews I read that I really thought was cool. And someone basically said that this book is good for people who just like art. It's not necessarily, you know, a Christian talk, for instance. I'm sure there's a lot of that in it because it's such a big part of your life. My last question, though, along those lines, doesn't really have anything to do with faith, but we'll close it out here. So let's say I am a songwriter and, you know, I'm doing pretty good. My music's out there, but I'm like, man, I like really, really want to make a living doing this. I'm going to try to write a number one song. And people say I'm a good artist. I write good music. Oh, man, that's an artist right there. But I'm like, I really want to support myself with this music. I think I can write a kick-ass number one hit. And if I can make a couple million dollars off of that, then I can go back to doing whatever I want. Is that lacking integrity when it comes to art?
Yeah.
That's a sellout.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
And you can't punk rock out of Josh, man.
You can't. I feel really strongly about this in particular. But I would say this. I do think that there are, when it comes to art and creativity, there are purely creative endeavors. And that's when you're beholden to no one other than your convictions and God. Or, you know what I mean? Like, you make what you want to make. And I think that in a purely creative endeavor, you should not be beholden to an audience. like people you know, or like the wide audience that would eventually receive the work if you finish it. You should make what you want to make. For example, I write the book I want to read. I write the song I want to hear. You know, one of my favorite quotes, and I use it all the time, is from the novelist Bret Easton Ellis. He was asked how often he thinks about the reader when he writes, and he said, never. He said, I don't think about the reader ever, and I don't care. The reader is me. And I think that, you know, Nick Cave talks about this a lot as well. He says, to love an audience, you have to provoke them and ultimately lose a lot of them. Like, and by that, I think he means like, when you write from a place of authenticity or paint or craft or whatever it is that you do, meaning you make the thing that you feel like you can make, that you want to make, that tends to find its audience a lot of the time. Sometimes it might be really narrow and small, but the reaction that it creates in that audience is profound. Or you can water it down with the audience's expectations, and it could reach more people, but the impact will be less profound, less lasting. That's a purely creative endeavor. Then there are semi-creative endeavors, and they have their place in art and entertainment as well. Think about like liturgical art, for example, a sermon or a worship song. That should not be just according to your sensibilities, because it's expressly designed to facilitate a certain thing.
Yeah, there's a function song, to it.
There, yeah. It has a function. Yeah, yeah, it has a specific function. Writing sermons is a creative thing to do. You know, it takes ingenuity and craftsmanship and all that. But I need people to understand what I'm saying. You know, and I need my points to land. And so you compromise on pure creativity for the sake of clarity. And the same can be said about, you know, like entertainment as well. I think that we know for sure there are artists, they're still artists, they still make art, that do factor in the audience's expectation and financial considerations. And they think like it'll sell better, it'll play better, more people will get it, all that kind of stuff. And then therefore will be more beneficial to my livelihood. And it doesn't mean that it's not creative at all, but it is, I think, in principle, a kind of compromised creativity. By definition, because you're considering something other than just the art for the art's sake. That has its place, and you can do that, and lots of people do. But I think it is a compromise of integrity to be like, well, I'm not really making the thing that I want to make. And there are artists who make the thing that they want to make, and it just finds a big audience. They're kind of, you know, the rare exceptions to the rule. But more often than not, I'm convinced personally that you water it down, you kind of end up with the thing that appeals to most people, but at a lower superficial level. When you don't water it down, it appeals to less people, but in a more profound kind of way. But,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Take it from a guy who's, you know, very few people care about the stuff that I make. So.
Yeah, I used to always think that way, but now I can think along the lines of, like, imagine if you liked making these antique boats that your great grandfather made. They're made of wood. They're very sturdy. They're very durable, but I mean, they're handmade. You're making the, you know, it takes days and days and days to make, and then you can sell it for a decent amount, maybe, or maybe not, make a decent living out of it. But it's like, that's what you love. You love doing what your dad taught you because his dad taught you, and you just love making these boats, but you're having a hard time making a living. But you're like, man, I could make, let's just think of a different financial endeavor, for instance. Man, I could do something that I saw online, or I can do this or that for $1 million. Then I have my income and I keep making these boats and not have to worry about the financial stresses of doing something I love. I could put my example that I gave to you in that same category of an artist saying, this is the function. This is like with praise music. Mm-hmm. Hey, this function is to make money. And then I'll go back to my art. I totally see where you're coming from, but I could see someone, you know, doing it functionally, and I'd be a little more open-minded to it, I think.
Oh, I get that. Yeah, I mean, like, think of Brad Pitt. I've read that his philosophy is like he chooses his movies based on the algorithm of like one for me, one for them, one for me, one for them. So he chooses a role that's like he doesn't care if it's successful. It just sounds interesting to him. And then the next role, it's like the Hollywood, the blockbuster movie that's probably going to.
That's cool.
And he does that to kind of create a sensibility to his career, you know, that will enable him to do one for me as long as he does one for them. You know, I think that it, just because it's a compromised creative approach doesn't necessarily mean that it's worthless. It doesn't mean that it's bad. It just means that they're different. They're different approaches.
Awesome. With all its teeth, sex, violence, profanity, and the death of Christian art, go get it. It's been out for a good little month now. And settle a debate. We'll end it here. Settle a debate between my brother and I. Best MXPX album in your book.
Oh, easily The Ever-Passing Moment.
Really? Oh my gosh. You did not settle our debate because he's all Life in General. I'm all Buffalo. Man, I've never heard someone say Ever-Passing Moment.
Life in General and Slowly Going the Way of Buffalo are both 5-star records for me, meaning I don't have any complaints about them. But I think that The Ever-Passing Moment is the like apex of MXPX maturity. And I don't know anyone else who did what they did to be like, what if our melodic skate punk band was influenced by Elvis Costello? And you end up with this kind of like mature throwback, but still punk. And the melodies are so sophisticated. I think the lyricism on that record is really mature and introspective. I love everything about it. I love the production. It's roomier than the other records, which are really airtight, you know? And then that was it for me. Nice. After that, That was the end of there. Yeah. That's like that Ever-Passing Moment is like Pinkerton. And then I'm out after that personally.
Dang, really? Man, you're missing out on some good Weezer stuff. Holy cow.
No, okay. We could do a whole nother episode
there
on that.
There you go. There you go. Hey, we could do a whole, I was going to bring up AI making art because we talked about that on the Seacoast podcast. I was like, we can't even touch that. go forever and ever. Hey, this is great, man. I appreciate the time. And yeah, it's always good talking. So thank you.
Yeah, dude. Thanks for having me. It was a blast.
Something without the words to make it so. There are some things that you can't know till you already know. Like how much I would love you.